This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
All right, one.
We've arrived.
I know, I was so used to seeing the thinking I was going to hear music. But cheers to you, Jeff. Welcome to the film scene.
Thank you. Oh, I should not show the brand of this silver can.
That's okay. We've still got it. We're halfway through quarantine. How you doing this week?
Fine. I busy but good. I watched something this weekend. Oh, I rewatched Popstar, the Andy Samberg, Yorma Taconi, the Lonely Island film. Really, yeah. Think that's a great movie from the last decade. If no one's watched it, very funny film.
I watched shows how we're completely not in sync. I watched a movie, a film noir. Sent to me by our friend Alan Rohde, who was on the show last week, Too Late for Tears, starring Elizabeth Scott and one of my favorite people in the universe, Dan Duryea. So it was a film noir, excellent film. Elizabeth Scott was great in it. She was like a 40s femme fatale. Actually, one of the first times I came to L.A., she was actually working out in the gym that I was in. Could not be more excited. I got to talk to her. Is there any celebrity that you've ever met aside from me that you talked to and you were really excited about?
The one person I get more starstruck over writers than I do over actors typically. And a writer I love, she worked on the show 30 Rock, which I think is one of the best comedies of this millennium, I would go as far as to say.
Terrific.
Producer on that show named Kay Cannon, who went on to write the Pitch Perfect movies. You won't be shocked to learn that I was very earnestly in an a cappella group in college. So I was supposed to be the one to write the first like musical a cappella comedy, but I was so heartened when Kay Cannon did it and wrote it perfectly. She recently directed a movie called Blockers, which was a pretty funny movie with John Cena.
I have not seen that.
It's good. It's sort of a subversion of like the sex comedies we're used to, but female driven. It's an interesting take on teenage coming of age. It's a good movie.
So a couple things. There's some questions coming in, but just in the topical section of the world. I know there was this big story about Trolls. Wouldn't have Trolls made $100 million anyway, even if it had?
I would have thought too. It's funny. I think it's more that it made the money so fast. The movie hasn't been out for very long, and it's making money more quickly.
Okay.
Than the previous incarnations.
Yes. I think, you know, I mean, you look at the, you know, there are all the times that they've said, oh, Broadway is dead. And then Broadway, it came back and it's bigger than it's ever been.
Right.
I think that I have confidence that, you know, yes, some things aren't going to be as, you know, but everybody's always ready to jump on the movie business. That, like, why isn't anyone saying, well, the airlines are going to be out of business, or you're never going to be able to sit all cramped up like that, which is more my concern. Like, when we come back, we better have better seating in the airlines. I'm not as nervous about sitting next to someone in the movie theater. That doesn't bother me, as long as the seats are cleaned and there's a lot of room in a movie theater. There's no room on an airplane. And same thing with working on a film set, which is the other big thing. You know, there's all these memos being circulated about ideas to get us back to work. And yes, I think there'll be some modifications, but the danger is, you know, that again, you go to the extreme that you're only, you know, doing movies that only have CGI or the one man show, or, you know, that there aren't any crowd scenes anymore. I think that's going to be problematic, that it's going to look strange. But
there's a couple great movies. One movie I love that doesn't really have a crowd scene is The Big Chill. I rewatched that movie about a month ago. There's one funeral scene, but most of that movie is just people chatting in a room. And I will say, I love a good small ensemble film if it's done well. So one thing I hope is that as we ease back into like big productions, we get some really, really great character-driven indies like The Big Chill.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting, you know, or do you put the what you were working on the shelf and you just wait a year? And I think that within a year, 2 years, you know, I don't think we'll ever be back to normal, but I think that, you know, certain things will, that some of these restrictions will, you know, will ease off. I don't think there's ever going to be where the problem lies is they're not going to be able to have 100 people on set.
Right.
And that's too bad. Unless everybody gets, you know, sort of tested. I don't know. I mean, I would not feel terrified at this point going and working on a film set.
You know, at a certain point we need to reopen because like the economy will die harder than, you know, it's like you have to weigh all the cost benefit analysis of all this. Interestingly, the one production, and I'll keep it quick because I know we probably don't have a ton of reality TV fans, but The Bachelor, you know, is like the economic backbone of ABC. And what they're doing for their next season is taking the one suitor and all of the contestants who are vying for their heart and the crew and locking all of them up in a resort in Mexico for 2 weeks before filming. So the whole crew, all the producers, everyone who's involved will be together just then. Yeah. And then they'll stay at the resort and shoot. Crazy.
Yeah, that's funny. That's the movie I did in Hawaii, which was called Knots. The bad title, K-N-O-T-S. That's basically what we did. We went to Hawaii. So I would totally be down for that. I'd be down for the quarantine for 2 weeks.
You know, you can rehearse. It's like a great time.
That's how movies used to be made, actually.
I know.
Go on location. Okay, before we get to Hal, let's answer a couple questions. Another question. This is from Joycea Crew. Well, what did you do to research your part in To Die For? Had you ever, did you know anything about Pamela Smart or the Smart family? Pamela Smart was the woman who was involved with the student and had the student kill her husband. Because I grew up in that area, Massachusetts, Connecticut, I was well aware of the murder. And so I just did my own research and I read Joyce Maynard's novel, which isn't, you know, a truthful account, but I do follow, I followed all the research of that, but it didn't, you know, go so much into my playing the part, although I was aware of it. And then Moving Pictures, my favorite. He or she always asks me great questions. What character would you like to portray that you haven't yet? God, that's so. I mean, I love the early days of Hollywood. You know, the beginnings of Hollywood. I would love to play someone like Dorothy Arzenor. You know, one of the first female directors, and tell her story about, you know, what it was like being the only female woman in the DGA. I think that would be something, that would be really interesting. I've never been in a Western. I've always wanted to be in a Western.
You've never been in a Western?
No, I've never been in a Western. Not that I can remember. Maybe I have. I mean, I did a Texas accent in Happy
Texas. It's John Harrison.
Wait, say that again?
That's right. I was saying, if we're talking about important females in film history, I'd love to see you play Joan Harrison.
Oh, I would do that in a second. Okay, what is this question? Do you have a desire to write and direct your own movie? Yes, I do. I have a couple projects I'm working on. They all have crowd scenes in them. So, I don't know what's going to happen with that, but wish me luck. Vittorio Pazzini, he's asking me about a movie. I did a commentary for a movie called Model Shop.
Oh, yeah.
He says, do you think it'll ever come out in the U.S.? Arrow never answered when we asked last year. Geez, I don't know. Ask Arrow Films. I have no idea. Bass Trilogy is asking, what was the first movie I was in? The first movie I had a part in was New York Stories, with directed by Martin Scorsese, and it was part of the trilogy, Woody Allen and Coppola. And that was the first movie. And I think that's, oh wait, what was the last? All right, one more question. This is from Chokerer. What do you consider to be the best film you were ever in? He suggests possibly Ghost World, just ahead of Goodfellas. The best movie I was ever in, I mean, I always say my favorite movie was Grace of My Heart.
Yeah.
It's because, you know, I helped produce it and develop it. And it was really a labor of love. And it was about the Brill Building and music in the 60s. So it was very much in my wheelhouse. So Grace of My Heart, I think was possibly one of the best movies I was ever in. Of course, Goodfellas is like, come on. And yeah, in terms of the pantheon of movies I was in. But, you know, Pluto Nash has its moments.
It's fair.
On that note, let's bring Hal in. I'm really excited.
It's going to be the best. You guys know Hal Sparks. It's funny, my reference for Hal Sparks is, Ileana and I were talking earlier, the I Love the 90s Zero series on VH1. I'm the perfect age for that as my entree to Hal Sparks. But a lot of iconic roles. Yes, I know.
Perfect age is actually the best way to bring me in, I think, honestly.
Well, you do preserve a strong youth, Hal. I gotta say, as someone who grew up on you, I guess it's 2 decades ago now, you look pretty good.
You look Thanks. Insane.
Yeah, right. The painting in my attic looks like crap, though.
Now, don't you think it's bad feng shui for Joe Biden to be in the basement? It's just like an odd...
Sure, unless you think straight up bunker, you know what I mean? It wouldn't be, when you have an onslaught, that's not a bad place for a leader to be.
Well, the only reason I say that is they say, you know, Jungian theory is that when you dream about a basement, it's sort of, you know, not when you dream about the attic, it's like your higher presence.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, can you imagine the Anne Frank jokes, though, if he was in the attic? So I don't know that there's a way to win, you know, because here's what you have when you have a 70 some odd year old man running for office in the middle of a pandemic that seems to be wiping out people in that exact age range. You have three options: the basement, the ground floor, or the attic. The attic seems like they put you away in mothballs. The basement sounds like you're a general, I think, you know, underground waiting for society to reemerge like Chud or the Eloy or whatever in the time machine. And ground floor at a bay window, he'd look like one of those people at an old folks' home where they're waving at their relatives through glass. I just don't feel like there's a win. So I figure you just go with whatever place has the best Wi-Fi.
I have so many questions to ask you. I got to keep on track here.
And I have all the answers.
Okay. Now, first question is, now one of my favorite things about this pandemic is I love seeing the inside of people's houses.
Sure.
I love it. And you're like, for instance, your background is fantastic. I love it.
Yeah, it's alive. No BS bookcasing going on here. I will say that for just, you know, class, I should have moved the fan away from the acoustic temporarily, but I was getting stuff out of the closet and it just couldn't be done. I mean, I was in a rush. But yeah, this is what I would call a WYSIWYG background. Yeah. What you see is what you get. This is for real. There's nothing I haven't arranged anything or disarranged anything to try and promote myself. It's not like these, the bookcase crowd, please show me. And if you have two books published and both of them are sitting forward on the shelf, piss off. It's the rudest thing.
Did you happen to see Ricky Gervais on Jimmy Fallon? He put all of his awards like right behind his
desk. Yes, he's got a shelf of that. That's actually, I would count that as WYSIWYG as well, because that's who he is. You know, he's one of those guys who mocks fame while trying to collect as much of it as possible. You know what I mean? It's like somebody with like all the Beanie Babies in the world making fun of someone who collects Barbies. It's the weirdest epic. Yeah. Like, that's you, dude.
I know.
And by the way, all my awards are on a small end table on the staircase. So where I think they should be appropriate. If you're on your way upstairs, you deserve to know who you're dealing with.
Now, right before this began, mm-hmm. we were communicating, but now we've never met. Maybe we've met. I don't remember.
I don't think so. No.
Okay. We have a lot of friends in common, I think.
That's true.
But right before this was happening, you were on plane. You were traveling.
Oh, yeah. Oh, to China.
Yeah. So.
And cruise ships. I've been to every hot zone there is. I swear to God. I did a live show in Seattle 2 weeks before lockdown. I was on 20 commercial flights in 3 months at minimum.
Yeah.
If you don't count bounce throughs. And I was in China and or working with the production team from China all of last fall. And whatever anybody tells you, by the way, about this, it started very much in the middle of October in China. Wow. The awareness of it anyways.
Yeah.
So if anybody has the antibodies, it should be me. I would, as the president say, donate some plasma. Ew, plasma. I'd love to donate some plasma if I thought it would help, but I can't get a test to know if I have it or not. So I'm sequestered away like everybody else.
I have a feeling you're pretty good because if you went through all of that.
All of it. Yeah. I literally having just been in Seattle right before that was the kicker. Like, really, we're going to do we kicked off the Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour in Seattle. It was insanity.
And how do you feel about this? You know, everybody's talking. I always feel like, all right, don't keep killing the movie business. You know, this idea of like, when we go back, things will never be the same. And I think they'll kind of eventually be the same.
Oh, of course it will. Here's what I would recommend people do. Go look at footage, reels from the 20s. And understand that in 1920, when the flappers started and the roaring 20s, the roaring 20s were a year, basically the last deaths from the Spanish flu happened in 1920.
Wow. Yeah.
So, I mean, and imagine, look at all the crowds gathered for ticker tape parades and all that kind of stuff. And understand that was after the Spanish flu, where we had none of the technology we have for tracking and tracing. None of the vaccines available that we would have to deal with this. There's no Oxford vaccine 6 months away in 1919, right?
Yeah.
So, like, the idea, I mean, the 60s happened after the tuberculosis epidemic and the Spanish flu and the Black Plague, if we've forgotten that. I mean, honestly, you think crowds didn't gather, you know, after the Black Plague? Like, hello? So history will move on. It's a matter of timing. The question will be, and by the way, do I think we'll be wearing masks out regularly? No, I don't. Do I think we will ultimately, what this will lead to is a push forward for solving the coronavirus issue as far as immunity goes, meaning a flu vaccine that's, you know, more reliable, that's and omnipresent, that deals with all coronaviruses. There are, you know, that's what Oxford was working on when they started putting this one together. And I think this will speed that up, because why do you want to wait for just the next version if you can beat the main protein that makes a coronavirus work, you know? Well, but I'm getting all sciencey, sorry.
Like I said, I don't want to spend so much time on it, but we're in show business and I feel like we're very much affected. And this idea of like, you got to go to a hotel and quarantine for 14 days. It's like, why don't you just clean the trailers? Why don't you just, I think most performers feel like, you know, a little more thorough cleaning of where we work backstage might
would
actually
solve a lot. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure I would have caught fewer colds while I was on Queer as Folk if we'd actually had dressing rooms in the building and we didn't have to walk through 2 feet of snow in slippers to do a nude scene in a warehouse in Barrie, Ontario. So yeah, those kind of standards. I mean, actually, you know, that's why I think most people laugh about like that actors have a union at all, but because it's a job that many people would do for free, the chance for being taken advantage of is actually far higher than in a situation where people are working in a factory where things are physically dangerous, where people, you know, where you're seen as a specific technician. And so I think, you know, that it needs it. We need it more than anybody. I've had several setups where the sanitary conditions were wanting. So yes.
I think we all have been in trailers like, oh boy, who is.
Yeah. Right.
Here before us. Okay. Let's
James Garner would have never put up with this. Yeah.
Let's get to serious things. Hal, you're in Vegas now, right?
I am. Yeah, that's right. I live here and LA. So I have a house in both places because I'm back and forth all the time. My girl and I live in Vegas. And then I'm in LA all the time because that's where my band is. That's where my best friends are. And it's also where my production rehearsal space is. Yeah.
Jeff was saying at the top of the show, you think you're from Ohio. Do you remember the first movie? Well,
I was born in Cincinnati, but I grew up in Kentucky. I was only born in Cincinnati because my mom was visiting my grandmother when she went into labor. That's where they're all from. And that was the nearest hospital without chickens. So I was born in Christ Hospital on my mom's birthday on the 25th of September, on her 25th birthday in room number 5 at Christ Church, the same room she was born in. And yes, there was a comet. First movie I ever saw that I remember was my mom took me to see The Shining.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I was 7. Yeah. Eight. I was just turning 8. And there was a reason for it. She'd read the book. And my mom's a big reader. And we're big readers. So I had to leave Kentucky. And she'd read the book. And in the book and in the movie, ultimately, the kid is the only smart one. Everybody else is either stupid or a maniac. You know, all Scatman Crothers character aside, because in the book he lives and in the movie he dies, spoiler alert. she was like, he figures out how to survive without anybody's help. And so this isn't really a horror movie for the kid character. So it's fine. And the books I was reading at the kid, I was a sci-fi reader and all this stuff. So she knew it wasn't going to panic me. And so we went to the movies. You can't leave me home out in the woods. So what's scarier, taking your kid to see The Shining or leaving him in the sticks for 3 hours? So, yeah. So that was the one. And I mean, it's still one of my favorites.
And it didn't, I mean, the scene with the twins, it didn't like scar. I can't even look at that scene or when he goes to the old woman's coming out of
the old woman's the worst. The old woman with the boily body and all that kind of stuff. That's gross. Yeah, no question. That was the one that stuck with me and was the most frightening.
Yeah.
But right after that is the scene where Danny's sucking his thumb and he's got his sweater ripped. And uh-huh. I remember as a kid going, you escaped. Like I, like 7, 8 years old, like he got away. Who cares if she ripped your shirt? You're not bruised. You're fine. You know, and I, at that point, I'd like fallen down a hill, been bitten by a snake and almost drowned 3 times. Like, you know, redneck kid. I was like, so by my standards, what happened to Danny in that movie was like Christmas, you know, it's like winter break with my grandparents falling out of a boat into a water filled with snapping turtles. It's fine. So I, that moment right afterwards erased that fear of that even thing. Cause the kid escaped. Right.
Yeah.
Now I love all the Room 237. I don't know if you've seen the documentary about it.
Yes.
Yes. And there's tons of theories, and the ones that, you know, it's all Jack, you know, that there's no ghosts at all. And then I like the idea that I do think that gets washed away by the fact that he's in the picture at the end. I do think that I love alt theories. Like I love the alt theory about No Country for Old Men, that there is no the assassin character is a figment of the main character's imagination. It's just where he goes into his dark space when he kills people he loves or cares about. Like, that's fascinating to me. I love that idea. But in The Shining, I kind of don't buy it. I'm like, nah, I like the idea. Old Indian burial ground, they're mad. They want everybody there to suffer. Everybody who stays there for any length of time goes nuts. Yeah, okay, I can live with that. And, right.
Now, when you were, did you, you're like a renaissance performer.
It's true.
You've got all these different, Did you start out wanting to sing or do comedy or act? Like, which came first? Because you've done everything.
Yeah. When I grew up in Kentucky, the idea of doing any of it was all fantasy or just impossible. Like, there is no, when you grow up in Peeksmill, Kentucky, there is no, you know, musician, like rock star anyways. You could be a bluegrass musician at the local pub maybe, but there is no, there are no actors or comedians, you know, that's not a job. That's something that happens magically to other people. And whoops, my camera always does that. I'm back. I'm fine. So the trick was, you know, when I moved to Chicago, suddenly everything was possible. Chicago, there's no magic in Chicago. Chicago is a very practical, artistic town. If you want to be a musician, learn to sing or play an instrument and get at it. Like, it's so blue collar in its approach to the arts that that's the beauty of Chicago more than any other city. Yeah. And same thing with theater, like and improv and comedy. There's no, like, nobody taps you on the shoulder. So when I got to Chicago, Second City was one of the places that I'd heard about before I came up there that I wanted to be interested in. And to me, that was full of people who acted and performed, like, you know, people like Martin Short who acted and sang and did comedy. And, yeah. And you know, that mix, I was like, and growing up, oddly enough, and I'm sure you feel this way, but it wasn't weird not so long ago that actors could do more than one thing.
So definitely.
You know what I mean? Yeah. You had to do it all, or, you know, that's the, I mean, you know, the Gene Kelly's one of my heroes. And I, just the fact that he danced and acted and sang as well as he did. And it was no, he was expected to, why wouldn't you, you know? So the idea was everything that's a talent you should use, whether it becomes financially viable or not, it should be an integral part of your life if you are drawn to it. And I think talent is just falling in love with something before everyone else does. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. If you fall in love with acting 3 years before your friends do, you'll be the actor in the bunch because you spent 3 years studying it, watching movies from an actor's perspective, reading books on it, taking classes, doing scene study, all that stuff. And when you're a teenager, it's awesome. It's a great time to learn a new talent because the third year of anything you're learning sucks. If you're learning a foreign language or an instrument or how to act or build birdhouses or woodworking, it doesn't matter. The third year sucks. You plateau really badly. You can't make any progress. You're like at the ends of your physical ability. And then you break through after that if you keep at it. But the third year always sucks. That's why the world's full of yellow belts. Everybody's got a yellow belt in something. And they don't get their green belt and then their brown belt and then their black belt because the third year sucks. But when you're a teenager, that though all of those years suck. So there's a freedom in, you know, well, I'm not blaming the guitar for why my day sucks.
Yeah.
This isn't why it sucks. It's the, you know, it's the life. So I was able to, at that moment, because of the timing of moving to Chicago, everything sucked so bad that all the hard things about being an actor, like auditioning and rejection, all the you know, stuff that you hear about from people, didn't scare me at all. Like I mean, I was this redneck kid with a peach fuzz mustache, poor as a, you know, as a church mouse, moving into one of the richest districts in Chicago and live in a guest house that my dad and I had to rebuild so we could pay half rent so I could go to a better school. So when all the rich kids were bitching about, you know, auditions they were going on, I was like, are you kidding me? This is sweet. Even getting to do the awful parts was awesome. So, I've never been, you know, that's never held me back. So I just love, if I love something, I just dive into it.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Yeah. I mean, that's my philosophy too.
Yeah.
I never give up. I always think it's, I take that same acting school philosophy because we did that too. We had to learn fencing and Shakespeare.
Yeah.
You have to do everything, you know? So you always have something up your sleeve was the idea.
Well, you know, back in the day too, you had to pad the bottom of your resume with every possible secondary skill in case that was the one thing. Yes. Yeah, but can you ride horseback? Yes, I could ride horseback. You know, everybody had horseback riding on the thing, even if they'd never seen a horse in person. because they figured I can pick it up in a couple of days. It's fine.
You remember when people would say that they could drive a shift car? That was like a big deal.
Yeah, still is.
Yeah, you know, like they put like shift can drive shift.
Yeah, and because it after a while it mattered. Even today, that's not, you know, that's something, you know, in a movie or a film, you're either gonna, you know, that's a make or break in a moment for somebody in a commercial. Even that's a big deal.
Yeah, to have I always love to be that person on the set where you're like, I know a little bit about that, or
totally.
I could tie a knot or.
You know. Right. Yeah. I went to Boy Scout camp. I got my emergency preparedness merit badge. I can make a splint out of some popsicle sticks. Right.
It's so funny. We're the Gen Xers get totally passed by in my opinion. And we were the ones, I think that because we were all latchkey kids, we sort of developed a lot of other.
You just got on with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the beauty of being a latchkey kid in many ways, was just, you know, there's nobody there to help you necessarily. Like, and there were no, this was pre-texting. This is pre, you know, because I think I turned 18 when texting started, right? And I didn't even have a pager or anything even close to that, or a phone that could text for another two, maybe 3 years.
Yeah.
And so you needed a phone. Or help was not coming, you know? So.
Now, did you have any, when you were in LA starting out, did you have any friends that you came up with that you were, you know, going to auditions?
I had a buddy that I moved out to LA with. We were going to be writers together, and like, he wanted to go. And I wanted to go. He was slightly older than me, and we'd both been at Second City together. And then we were out here. I had a kids game show that I hosted. I'm the youngest game show host in history. Thank you.
No, I saw that on your Wikipedia page.
Yeah, that's how you can tell a self-starter. And I had that just before I moved out to LA. So I had a little pocket money, not a lot, because it was Haim Saban before Power Rangers. So there was, you know, it wasn't a deep pocket production. But I had at least the idea that there was going to be work, and I got out there and I was ready to grind forever. I had a 7-year plan minimum for getting my first thing. I didn't give a crap. I called the 90s the Sisyphus years, because I just kept rolling the rock up the hill, watch it roll back down. I don't care. It's my job, I guess. And, but my buddy, 6 months in, he had like this weird girlfriend up in Idlewild, and he had all this other stuff going on, and it was just all emotionally difficult, and he'd picked some really bad friends and gotten a crappy job, and he went home for Christmas break and never came back and owed like $3,000 in rent and phone, which was all in my name.
Oh my God.
And so, And so I basically all the gains of that year had been wiped out in 4 days. Ugh. Yeah, in 1989. And I was like, okay, this is it then. Is that the worst you could do to me? Okay, let's do this. And I had those like Michael J. Fox in Secret of My Success moment, you know, or
yeah.
Like, all right, LA, you think you can beat me? And, I just decided that I was going to soldier, and my goal has always been, luckily, that I want to be Burgess Meredith or like an old, like Hume Cronin. That's my goal as an actor. Alan Arkin, you know, like be the old funny guy in the movie.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, that's my goal. That's my ultimate characters. Like, that's what I want to, if I ever win awards for acting, that's when I want them to come. That's the kind of roles. And until then, I'm just building the scaffolding that holds that up as an actor and as a performer and skill set wise. So I didn't really have to worry about like breaking when I was young. And that took a lot of pressure off.
Mm-hmm.
What appeals to you about, I mean, like, I love Alan Arkin. When I think of Nebraska is one of my favorite movies. I think Bruce Dern's amazing in that movie. But, like, why specifically are you interested in, like, the quirky, like, elder?
Because there's a certain kind of comedy that you cannot do through a young physical body.
Hmm.
It won't ride. It doesn't make sense. It seems too cute by half. it's there's just something that being an older person that delivers certain comedic things that are just impossible when you're young. And that's, yeah. You know, don't get me wrong, I'm hysterically funny right now, but there will be something to being 85 years old and still got it, that kind of funny. And I just, there's a joy in it that I find that past that, you know, DGAF kind of zone that people get in. Yeah. And it's, they're so relaxed in what they do in spite of everything.
Yeah.
So like Alan Arkin in, look at like, So I Married an Axe Murderer. That's a great comedy and it's such a joy to watch, but everybody in that movie is working except Alan Arkin. Alan Arkin is being that police chief who, you know, is trying to be the tough guy for his, you know, for his subordinates to make them feel like they have a real meaning in their life. That he just flows through that. And you can't do that if he was the same age as Mike Myers. It just wouldn't ride. It wouldn't, you know, from a casting standpoint, it wouldn't make sense. Yeah. There's certain people who have a relaxed feel about them when they perform all the time. But often that lends itself more to drama than comedy. As a, you can be a young, flowing, dramatic actor very easily.
Yeah. I agree. I think that as you get older, you can develop a certain persona. You know, even I was thinking of somebody like Harrison Ford. Aside from him with all of his plane crashes, but he's inherently funny when he comes on screen. He doesn't even have to talk.
Your medicine, Jack. He, you know, on a side note, I was getting my pilot's license before all this nonsense happened, and I study at the same airport he crashed at. And for the record, he is a legend at that airport for that landing, because anybody else would have died. Period. He, the only way in that plane is basically a paper airplane with a rock in the front of it.
Right.
If it loses power, it just goes like that. The only, if you try to what they call the impossible turn, if you try to go back, you lose power and you try to go back to the airport, you just fall to the side and die. The only way to live in that moment is point the plane straight at the ground.
Yeah.
And then within 80 to 100 feet of the ground, pull out entirely and level out and smash the bottom down onto the ground. He was off by 20 feet. Mm-hmm. Like, think about your visual judgment, 100 feet. What's 100 feet away from like falling straight at the earth in 8 seconds? The dude is amazing. Like, I love Harrison Ford. And I've always, you know, I just watched The Conversation with Gene Hackman.
Yes.
And I didn't remember, I didn't know that Harrison Ford was in that.
Yeah, very small part,
Yeah, as this, you know, it was funny, his part was bigger than Robert Duvall's, but still both of them were like, you know, placeholders in this weird little movie, you know. You know, After Hours meets The Package, I suppose. He was so young in it and so still, you know, like that was an interesting thing to watch him, because he learned later to make, you know, faces doing stuff. Like if you look at Han Solo,
he's
and even to some degree Indiana Jones, he's actively moving his face. He's choosing, and his cry trigger is his chin. All he has to do, if he starts wiggling his chin, he'll start crying. That big. So that's where his cry comes from. That's his cry trigger. And so it's funny. I've watched it in several movies. And when he gets there, I'm like, okay, if his chin starts moving, the tears will follow. It's not the other way around.
Yeah. I like him in, I can't think of the movie. Didn't he play wasn't he in the movie about the mean baseball guy? I can't remember the name of it.
42, you mean?
Yeah, is that it? Where he's
That's where he was like, "Your medicine, Jack." That's what I'm talking about.
I like him in that one. He's a little
As the crotchety, he wants to play old character parts. You know, and he's been zoning for that. You know, and it will give him a certain freedom that being the handsome leading man took away from him. You know, for a while. You know, as far as character, De Niro's argued, you know, that's what he tried for. You know, as well. You know, opening up. Although I always thought he had great comic timing in spite of himself. Like Midnight Run, forget about it. Like such a goddamn, it's such a good movie.
Yeah, he has his timing is like off timing. He's got like Frank Sinatra timing. It's not on. It's not like Joe Pesci timing. He's kind of he's got his own delivery.
That's right. Plus, you'll wait for him because he's De Niro.
Right. Well, which again makes it challenging working with him because you have to get it. You know, as everybody you work,
yeah,
who has that same weird rhythm as Christopher Walken. He never delivers the line.
I've heard that before, but not from so many people. You know, the taking out the punctuation, Abby. Yeah, so I don't doubt it for a second. I mean, there's certain people where you're just, their face will throw you off. That's why I've always had, it's always why I've always questioned method acting, because if you're playing Abraham Lincoln and you're being Abraham Lincoln and you are Abraham Lincoln and you're living as Abraham Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln would go, where did all these wonderful microphones come from? Where, who are all these strange people? What are these devices? I've fallen through a hole in time. So.
Okay, Hal, I'm having so much fun talking to you. We're going to run out of time here.
What happens?
Before we get to your classic, do you know Wayne Fetterman, the comedian?
Yeah.
So we call it a Fetterman and out, like where you're in one scene and then you're out, you know,
yeah. But
everybody remembers you. That the in Dude, Where's My Car? And in Spider-Man, you have those kind of like that where everybody remembers that more than the movie. But
right.
Before we get to those movies, we have to talk about the VH1 shows and Talk Soup, which were so much a part of my. That's all we watched in the
90s.
I don't think did they go to the aughts or were they out in the 90s?
No, we did, I Love the 2000s or something like that. We were going to do like the millennium. There's a variation of that. I don't doubt that we will end up doing something like that. I'm surprised they haven't done it already, but I don't know that it'll be VH1. That's the funny thing. And I don't think it matters. But yeah, those things were weird because
they were funny.
When they first came to me about them, I was shooting Queer as Folk. I had had this thing where I'd gotten Talk Soup. I'd done a year's Talk Soup, and then I had I got fired. And then within 2 weeks, I was shooting Dude, Where's My Car? And then while I was shooting Dude, Where's My Car? I got Queer as Folk, and then I moved to Canada to do Queer as Folk. Like my life just kind of went just. Snowballed in this really weird way, you know, where you don't see it coming. And I recognized that, like when I first got Talk Soup, people would go, "Hey, Talk Soup guy," like that. And when I got Queer as Folk, people were like, "Michael," you know, and you know, dude, Where's My Car? At least it was Zoltan. There are very few Zoltans in the world unless I'm traveling around Hungary. And so the idea that, you know, if somebody yells Zoltan, I can pretty much go like that and they'll laugh and applaud. But if someone yells Michael, there may be a Michael in the vicinity and you don't want to be a maniac and turn around and go, "Hi, yeah, it's me. Lucky you." And they go, "No, my real friend Michael's right behind you." And you're like, "Oh God." So I recognized that I needed people to know me by my name. And the most important thing was, beyond the acting thing, to let them, for people to know you're even acting or that your character differentiates from your actual personality, your character as a human being must be known.
Yeah.
And so I told my PR person at the time, I was like, "I will do anything where they chiron my name under my face. I don't care about the quality. Just get me on as many things that show my face and put my name right here." Mm-hmm. And VH1 called about this thing. They were going to do a documentary about the 80s, a 10-episode documentary about the 80s. And it's the way they presented it was boring as hell. And they were like, "What we want is a couple comedians, and we might have you do some red carpet stuff. But what we want to do is stand on red carpets and, like, ask Brad Pitt if he remembers the Rubik's Cube and stuff like that." And I'm like, okay, you'll never be able to fill a show with that, but good luck. And I was like, "And I'm not hosting anymore. Unless it's my own thing and I make it, because there's no point. It eats into acting. It'll kill you." So I was like, at that point, I was like, "No." But they said, "Well, would you come in and just do some talking head stuff?" And I was like, "Will you chiron my name under my head?" And they're like, "Yes, of course." And I was like, "I'm in. Cool." They brought me in for 30 minutes. I was there for 8 hours. Then they brought me back the next day and I finished the whole decade. So they just had a book and they were like, "Okay." And, so it was just like, it was crazy. So next thing you know, we're doing another one and another one. And only like five of us were paid to do it. Everybody else did it, you know, basically for the free press.
Yeah.
But it was like me, Michael Eaton Black, Rich Eisen, Rachel Harris, Mo Rocha. Yeah. Like, and a couple of others. And it was, I have to say, I would do every season in 2 days. It was the easiest work in that regard, but it was all improv. I wouldn't prepare at all. They would send you stuff if you wanted it. They would send you tapes, boxes of stuff. If you wanted every clip they were going to use and every quote they were going to make, they would send you a whole folder and stuff. And I was like, I don't want to see any of it. Because if I don't want to start writing, it'll look fake. And yeah. I want you to catch my own response about that real thing. Because to me, it's a documentary. Ask me then. And other by the second, everybody was like, Mo, I think, was bringing writers and they were sitting on the floor in front of him. You know, it was amazing. Like they were turning it into a real job. And I was like, you guys do homework? What is that? But it was just a, yeah.
I was going to say the reason it was so much fun is that there was a looseness to the way show business used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like, oh no, you can't say his name and you got to do this. And well, we're afraid of this. And whenever I've done hosting gigs at the 11th hour, they go, well, we're kind of concerned and we have a sponsor and we don't want you to say that. And it was like in the night, nobody cared about anything.
Nobody cared. Well, and I feel like that's going to come back to some degree.
Yeah.
Because we've got a sense of reality by the circumstance that we're in. And so this overreaction aspect that people were getting caught up in kind of goes away. Like when people go, they're just inserious about life if they want to be taken that seriously. I also think branding is a disease. And I would rather have a legend than a brand. And you don't have to protect a legend. It just exists with your flaws and everything. But a brand is something where like, look, we only talk about the things about me that are monetizable and fit the thing that I want to show to the world. It's like we've all become a housewife with furniture covered in plastic in 1962 with a drunk husband going, we're all fine. We're all fine. This is the face we show the world. Oh my God, the kitchen's on fire. You know, I feel like that's what branding is. It's just a false front. And I refuse to participate in it. I will use elements of stuff, but I think they have to fit the legend of who I am as a human being. Like my story as a being, you know, not my monetizable parts.
And then I have to ask you about Queer as Folk, just a terrific show and being a part of that. And do you see that coming back at all, that show?
They've talked to, you know, the fans want it. The cast is on board. It would really be up to Showtime to release the rights or to do it themselves. They did a version of one of the other shows. And brought them back for a little bit, the L Word, but not us. And I don't know if it's because we have a couple of problematic cast members or if it's just because they want to save it, as if you can these days, like you're going to wait and see if everybody survives before you decide to dust this off. So it's hard to say. Like I said, I'm on board for that.
Yeah.
And I think Michael has a continuing story to tell. There's definitely something there. I mean, you know, first we had the first HIV positive negative relationship on a series in American history. We had a first gay adoption. We had the first like two gay couples that had babies using other people's as surrogates.
Yeah.
We covered the gamut, you know, and it broke the mold in a lot of ways that had been kind of encasing the storyline about what gay people were like for a very long time. So, and I think a lot has changed since then, and sort of waking up to the new normal of that would be great too. So, I'm for it. I always thought they should have Law and Ordered it. And I pitched that to Showtime at one point where I was like, they should do Queer as Folk Miami and Queer as Folk LA or, you know, Queer as Folk, you know, Soho, something like that.
That's a great idea.
I agree with seven different people. And then our group had split up and you could have one person seed each place, you know, that Emmett went to San Francisco and started his own life there with a partner with Ted, and they started their own business there, and they have a group of friends around the Castro and built that idea. So you get that idea so that it's not so uniform, this kind of, you know, Midwestern version of this one group of friends, which is what it was, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
And, you can broaden out who the characters are, who they are in it, you know, and all that. So I think that would be wise. But it's not up to me. And in my life, I'm working on, you know, the projects for my future all the time, just how I have to be.
I got to ask you one film question, because I thought this was interesting. A couple things. You said, I believe the camera is a character in the movie. What does that mean?
Yes. Yeah, I believe that in the case of, I'm being brought a beverage by my girl. Yes. She snuck in. Thanks, babe. She snuck out and went to Black Rock for me. I don't like when the camera is part of the landscape, and that happens a lot with like 90s shaky cam was part of that. Like, oh, it's an intense scene, therefore the camera would also be shaking. And like, it can be a little crazy. I like it, you know, from a sort of a Kubrick point of view, where it's godlike and it tells you a story by telling you where you should look, because that's what's important. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of moving and godlike cinematography in that regard. But I think it's the narrator, because it's, you know, if somebody tells you a story, they're part of the story, because their interpretation of the story is this, you know, is what you're hearing, not the reality of the story. It's going through them, right? Mm-hmm. And so in the case of the camera, the color tones, the action, what's in focus and out of focus, what shifts and what doesn't, is like the camera is telling you the story, and therefore is part of the witness of the story, part of the being that was in the scene was there. The stranger sitting on the couch listening to the argument, the child in the stroller hearing the parents argue, the bystander at the gunfight who managed to see it coming before anyone else did, but was frozen and unable to move. Those kind of elements of it, agents of the attack, agents of the defense, who are in a battle scene. And so the how the camera tells that story is very much personality. Mm-hmm. And without it being personality, this kind of the slice of life, almost play-like differential.
Right.
Even that is, as Rush would say, if you choose not to decide, you still have made a choice. When Woody Allen would like pull the camera out and people would just be arguing in another room and you're just watching through a door.